Sanosa. I'm David McNeil from Caitlin G. Actuarial. I'm chairing a session on global developments and modelling and application of risk for life companies. We have three speakers for a presentation, and there should be some time for questions at the end. There's microphones on the floor on two sides I'll ask you to use, and the session is being recorded. Also, there's feedback forms that you have in your packs that you please fill them out on the terminal outside. I'll introduce Peter Larson, who will speak first, and he'll introduce his co-presenters, Mike Cullen and Michael Stundy. Peter's a director at Deloitte with over 15 years' experience across superannuation, insurance and wealth management. Since joining Deloitte in 2008, Peter has been involved in a broad range of complex actuarial projects, including valuation, modelling, capital, pricing and profitability. Prior to joining Deloitte, Peter worked for a large Australian life insurer and a number of finance actuarial roles, and has also spent over 10 years providing consulting and actuarial advice in all areas on superannuation and employee benefits. I hand over to Peter.
Thanks, David. What we're going to cover today is firstly just some comments from what we've seen around the traps a bit on the Australian sort of industry landscape. When I say industry landscape, then I'm referring predominantly to economic capital type frameworks, so risk-based frameworks. And then the two Michaels are going to talk more about from a global perspective. They've both joined Deloitte sort of fairly recently and have a wealth of experience both in sort of actuarial and technical modelling of risk type frameworks, but also working in industry roles, working with non-actuaries and businesses to try and communicate some of these concepts to people actually on the ground doing this sort of work. So hopefully you'll find it interesting. We do touch a bit on some technical modelling type aspects, but it's by no means a technical presentation. Apologies if that's what you came here for, but we're very much keeping it practical, business usage type focus. So hopefully you find it informative. Firstly, just some comments on the landscape, and starting with Australia. Actuaries have worked in modelling of risk and capital and those sorts of things for many years. It's certainly not new, and in more cases than not, they've rightly or wrongly tended to focus on regulatory capital a lot more than probably economic capital. And for a number of reasons, increased requirements of reporting and disclosure, etc., for regulatory capital over economic capital. But what we're probably seeing a bit of late in particular is a shift in this focus. So regulatory capital absolutely still very important and will remain a focus, no question of that, but an increased focus on ECAP and also economic profit as for a number of reasons. I think one, greater ownership by banks of wealth and life businesses, but also the conglomerate sort of standards or papers from APRA that came down last year or more than a year ago now, essentially increasing the requirements on the conglomerate groups to have an overall ICAP structure. So the ones that are sort of advanced accredited Basel II type institutions have done an awful lot of work in terms of internal models and what have you. And if they own wealth groups or life groups, sort of getting to the point where they can't just have this sort of bolt-on ECAP model on the side. It needs to be part of a integrated group, group-wide structure, and that of course has challenges for life companies who are falling under these group structures. So we're seeing, as a general comment, we're seeing a sort of a invigoration of ECAP frameworks and models around the place, and a refresh of looking at some ECAP models where a lot of good work's probably been done in the past, but maybe is now getting a bit more focus than it has done. So, in terms of overseas, the guys will talk more about that later, but a huge investment of work in terms of modelling and what have you in terms of Solvency II and other European top countries. I think probably fair to say, particularly in the UK, they're still very much focused on the Pillar 1 and building the models at this stage, and not so much focused on the areas of how that can be used to drive the business actions. The guys will expand on that a bit later on. So in terms of these challenges for for life companies in particular, and this for people falling under a group structure and increased focus coming down from above on these sort of risk-based and economic frameworks. I've tried to put a fairly simple slide up there, which is trying to communicate how some of these things are not simple. Sometimes you would have seen these things in more of a circular type presentation, more of a continuous loop here. I've gone across the page, many of the same sort of things that you would have probably seen. Essentially, for a given level of given portfolio of risks that you have, the board or the leadership of the company will have an acceptable level of risk that they'll be happy to take on via the risk appetite, quantitative or qualitative, and you need to hold a certain level of capital to cover those risks, and on that capital you want to earn a desired or acceptable level of return to meet all the stakeholders' requirements. And this is when it starts getting interesting, is how do you define that return, and then what do you use those returns for? And again, I've only got two versions of capital there, ECAP and regulatory capital, but regulatory capital will always be important, and it's the actual dollars that you're required to hold, so you cannot lose focus there. But I think also economic frameworks have a big role to play here in terms of these portfolio type decisions, and how do you assess performance and how do you allocate capital, and portfolio, I've called that portfolio optimization decisions. If you're the group CFO of a business and you have $100 to invest, where are you going to invest that money across the group? And in the green down at the bottom, I've tried to just sort of point out some of the challenges for companies trying to build these sophisticated frameworks, and it's not a simple thing to do, and it's by all means a learning process, a continually evolving process. So not only you have to build a robust model, a sophisticated model, it's one that has to be actionable or usable by the business, and this often means it needs to produce regular, frequent, granular information that people can understand it. It has to be integrated into the overall group structure, so if the risk appetite's being set up here above, but there's four different groups that sit within that, four different businesses that sit within that group, you've got to cascade that down, and there's a number of challenges involved there. And whilst changing in the red, a changing environment happening all along the way, which is taking up a lot of time just in itself, let alone trying to do these other requirements at the same time. So not an easy thing to do, and if it was an easy thing, I wouldn't probably be here right now. Here's some just observations on the Australian market from some of the work we see from time to time and dealings with clients, and I've tried to assess sort of economic capital frameworks, essentially. I'm still focused on that in four criteria down the left-hand side there. So we've got risk identification, are you capturing all the risks? And the quantification, so the technical modelling side of it, business usage, how often, how frequent, and how ingrained is the material being used, and governance structures. And I'll just maybe point out one or two points on each of those. I won't go through all those points. In terms of identification, I suppose risk capture is we sometimes see sort of catch-all models. So you'll see sophisticated model set up for one or two of the risks, and a lot of focus goes into that. And then another model that might be a business risk, say, for example, or something that essentially captures everything else, and it says, right, we know there's risks in there, but we're not going to explicitly model them. We'll just lump them in here, and we'll load it up with a bit of conservatism because we know there's stuff in there, but perhaps we haven't captured it all exactly. On balance, we believe we've got it all, but it's not explicitly captured there, and therefore it's hard to identify specifically exactly how much that is. I've put also there, complete business coverage. That's talking about when your business is growing and changing, or maybe there's mergers, acquisitions, those sorts of things. The models need to be able to grow and adapt as well as the business changes. So you can't just sort of scale up premium, for example, if you've got an insurance risk ECAP component and you buy a new business and you just say, right, my premium's gone up by 50%. I can't just lift up my insurance risk by 50%. Quantification. I made a comment there about bolt-on models. So you know, oftentimes you have very sophisticated models there for RegCap and it's running off the profit engine and linked into the same models that are producing policy liabilities and what have you. But then you may see the ECAP model just sort of sitting off to the side as a spreadsheet or something like that. So perhaps once it was a more robust engine and has sort of been left to sort of gradually decay over time or something, but quite often you don't see the same level there on the ECAP side as you do on the RegCap side when the engine is actually there already and being used for a number of other purposes. Business usage, I think, again, it's come back to the comment of for it to be sort of people to have confidence and transparency in it, they need to be seeing regular granular information. So if the reports and things coming through to management and boards and what have you are seeing monthly RegCap numbers by product and they can see movement analysis and things like that, but maybe they see ECAP numbers twice a year and just one number for insurance risk, one number for insurance business and one for investments business. You know, they're never going to get to the point where they can feel comfortable, feel confident with those numbers, be able to make decisions on those numbers at that sort of level. So we see a little bit of that. And governance, I suppose sometimes you see you don't have an overall owner, so there may be op risk owner, insurance risk owner, market risk owner, and no sort of overall owner sitting on top of all that just to make sure that it all hangs together and when you add it all up, it's sensible. So I think the final comment there down in green is also important about the overall sophistication and of the models that we see around the place is quite often linked to the priority that the business places on it. So if ECAP's not a focus, then obviously the models aren't going to be invested in. So if it's not driven right down from the top and essentially ingrained into the business, then why would people spend a lot of time building sophisticated models? I'll keep going. Just before I hand over to the other guys, I've just got a couple of little charts here from Deloitte does a global Solvency II survey. This one's from 2010, so it's actually nearly a year old now, so things might have moved on a bit, but I think it still gives a pretty good indication. I've just picked out a few charts on some of the key sort of modelling-related items. So the first one is about... this is UK Solvency II survey. It's about 100-odd companies, not just life and general. So very good coverage across the UK market. So the first one's about approach. Do they take the full internal model approach or other ways? And about, as of nearly a year ago, I suppose this is saying, around about half had adopted to take a full internal model approach for Solvency II. Now, I think if you just look at the larger end of the companies, that 49 becomes more like 70 to 75. So strong trend there. As you go across, the next one I've got is the modelling aspect. So still a big lot of people, they're undecided as to how they're going to go. They're sort of waiting for clearer instruction from the regulators. But for the ones who have chosen to say, right, I'm going to bite the bullet and push ahead, tends to be two approaches which have been the most commonly used. The replicating portfolio method, which some of you would have heard, and the other one there called curve fitting, which I'll just talk briefly on in the next slide. So the larger groups who have gone down that path have tended to focus more on the curve fitting approach, which I'll just briefly talk about on the next slide. And the last one's about aggregation. So are they doing sort of a full simulation type approach or another approach? And again, it's about 50% have taken for the full simulation, but again, that number's quite a bit higher if you just look at the bigger end of town. Not as many using the old covariance method these days, and the other captures things like copula and more sophisticated versions of variance, covariance. So very few actually going down the path of copula. I think it's less than 5%. And this is just a very quick slide on the curve fitting approach. So I've got their replicating formula, which is not to be confused with replicating portfolio. So replicating portfolio, some of you would be familiar with, essentially trying to create synthetic portfolio to match liabilities with assets. Replicating formula, or sometimes called curve fitting approach, is essentially just trying to model your liabilities as a function of some key risk drivers. And I've used a very simple example, it would be more sophisticated than this in practice. But if you can model your liabilities based on some drivers, and they may be things like equities index, volatility of interest rates, or unemployment may come into there for things like IP claims and things like that, you can essentially create a mathematical equation, and using your profit models or whatever models that you happen to be using, you can do a series of runs, and you can essentially can solve that equation using simultaneous equations. So that is actually being done. It's quite well developed in the UK. Deloitte does this pretty much. That's pretty much all it's done for about the last 12 months, and will do for quite a bit of time, I think. So look, it's all about trying to reduce the number of runs. If you're going for a full simulation approach and you want to do 10,000 runs on a full life insurance company, it's going to take you 3 months or something to run it. So this is all about getting the 10,000 number down to maybe 100. Still a lot of runs, don't get me wrong, but greatly reducing the time to be able to produce this material. Keeping in mind that the Solvency II requirements are a lot more onerous, I think, than our capital requirements. So Solvency II is more than just creating a required capital number. It's essentially creating a full balance sheet. So they've really gone to town, I think, is probably a fair way to say. Then the last point there, I think, is quite important as well, this can't just become a mathematical exercise. So you need to have people in there who've got judgment and experience to be able to, as you're solving for these equations and using runs and things, it can't just become crunch the handle sort of thing. It needs to be judgment involved in there to make sure it's sensible. Okay, I'm going to hand over to Mike Stumbles now, who's going to talk a bit more about his overseas experience.
Thank you, Peter. For the last 2 years, I've been working over in Switzerland, and I want to present two ideas to you today that come from that time over there. I was there for 2 years. I promise I have more than two ideas that came from it, but one for each year, kind of matching it. But I've only got a limited amount of time, so here were two kind of modelling ideas that I've brought back with me. The first one is with regards to capital and risk transfer instruments. Now, I think globally, following the global financial crisis, there's been a much greater focus in terms of the interconnectivity of different financial services companies within the industry as a whole. We heard about FISIs yesterday, and systemic risk and things like that. And following on from this, I think regulators in Europe have also started to look at modelling some of these relationships. Now, at an industry level, obviously that's extraordinarily complex. But maybe some regulators have started to look at, it makes sense to look at insurance groups. And within those groups, the different legal entities and different entities which are subsidiary to that or part of that, and how they relate to each other, and what happens to these relationships within that group during times of stress. This slide here, you'll see up the top, we've got a normal situation where capital flows are moving easily and freely between the different entities within the group. The second is where we start to get a little bit more stressed, and some of these capital flows start to dry up, some of these risk flows start to dry up. Perhaps some of them only move in accordance with some kind of legally binding agreement or a CRTI. And then, of course, if we hit catastrophic situations, what could happen there? Well, they could really dry up. We could get basically a fear situation where the group will only try to survive, and therefore you actually get individual legal entities looking out for their own interests, as they actually maybe have a fiduciary responsibility to do, the boards, but a completely different sort of scenario about how those capital and risk transfer instruments are affecting things and how that capital flows. So in terms of modelling these things, companies have typically to date taken two different approaches. One is to look at a consolidated approach for the entire group, and that is to sort of lump all of the assets and liabilities together and assume that there are free capital flows within that group and look at the whatever it is they're modelling, probably capital a lot of the time these models are for, in that consolidated view. And another way is to lift the hood, as it were, underneath those relationships and try and actually model what will happen to them in stress situations, under a capital situation where you're looking at an extreme scenario, trying to model what happens to these capital flows. So a second concept I wanted to talk a little bit about, which I saw a lot of overseas, is the use of scenarios. Now, I was doing a lot of work in terms of Solvency II when I was in Switzerland, and also Switzerland has what's called the Swiss Solvency Test, which is also a risk-based capital framework, which was introduced before Solvency II. Swiss Solvency Test actually incorporates the use of scenarios as a requirement for the Pillar 1 requirement for your quantification, your calculation of the number. Solvency II hasn't gone that far, but it certainly has started to see companies using scenarios a lot, most particularly around the ORSA requirement, which I'll talk to a little bit more in detail in the next slide. But generally speaking, scenarios are a tool by which we can look at, first of all, one concept being a multi-year horizon. A lot of the capital models which we see are 1 year, value at risk or expected shortfall in that 99 percentile or 1 in 200 year type event scenarios. And scenarios are one way where we can actually look at what happens over a more extended period of time. What happens if we get a degradation of experience over a period of time? We get hits coming one after the other. I mean, people sort of talk about stress testing and scenarios in the same breath, but I like to think that stress testing is actually a bit of a subset of scenarios, and scenarios where we're looking at a full multi-period projection of a set of circumstances, one way that the world might evolve. That could be coming from a single incident, and then that's the effect that just plays through, or it could be something that is a sequence of events happening one after the other. There are lots of different ways we can come up with these scenarios, sort of looking at historical events or making synthetic ones, or we could have bespoke ones to the individual company. The Swiss Solvency Test actually requires that a set number of them are used, but then also that some are created that are bespoke to the particular risks of the company. So there's a lot of different ways you can come up with these. Some comments about what can make them very effective and powerful. One way is to make sure that they are linking in quantitatively, and that you are varying market parameters as the scenario goes through and seeing what really happens then to your capital requirements or perhaps earnings, if that's what you're using the scenarios for. And that's all well and good from a quantitative point of view, but I think the real power of scenarios comes from being able to use them to communicate effectively with the board and through the company, and then also to plan around that the contingency actions and the mitigating effects that the company, mitigating choices that the board of directors might implement or management might implement in these different scenarios, and actually working through them as an exercise for the board to get them engaged. Yesterday, Ian Loughlin presented on risk appetite, and he made a comment which kind of struck me a little bit, which was presenting results of analysis to the board. But I think it's also important to try and engage the board, and scenarios are one way, and doing exercises around that where this can be a tool to achieve that. To make it work effectively, I think you really need to have a narrative. It has to be a narrative that's easily communicable. It has to be a narrative that doesn't necessarily make sense. It could be something that is beyond the expectations of people. It's aliens landing in the world blowing up. You probably won't get people engaged if you talk like that. But entertainment of the almost ludicrous is where you're starting from a lot of points in time with these scenarios, because you're looking at 1 in 200-year events. If things are really that rare, you could get pushback. So when you come up with these scenarios, it's important to be aware that that creative process will get laughed at and people won't entertain. Well, it's ridiculous that we could ever have a pandemic that has this effect. It's ridiculous that X, Y, and Z. So it's just something to be aware of, but having a narrative, I think, is also another sort of important element of a scenario that can really help it to be communicated to the board and through the business. I just wanted to finish by making a few comments on ORSA and ICAAP. This comes out of scenarios because scenarios have been sort of the backbone of a lot of the work that companies I've been talking to in Switzerland and around Europe are using to address ORSA in ways of, well, here are some of the attributes to compare what ORSA requires and what ICAAP requires, from what I can gather from the papers so far from APRA. The first being that the time horizon for these two is very similar. A lot of sort of market standard things that are being happening in Europe have settled on this kind of five-year time horizon, but that's not actually the requirement. The requirement is that it's a time horizon that's linked to business strategy. But again, we've got this multi-year horizon for the ICAAP, so extending beyond that quantitative model, which is just the one-year value at risk or one in 200 kind of year event. We've got this regularity that's required for both of them, where you need to go through the process or produce the report, and I think they're actually both, and continually assess the compliance with regards to capital requirements. And also you've actually got this requirement that without delay after a significant risk event you do it. I don't see that exact same drafting in the ICAAP, but I see something very similar, which says that capital at all times must be held commensurate with risks, which is a pretty strong statement at all times. So immediately after a risk event, that needs to be true as well. You need these links to business strategy again. There are very similar attributes, the setting of appetite, tolerance, limits, risk identification, measurement. They both require a linking to the overall business strategy of the firm. So given all these similarities, I guess I just wanted to make the point that there's a lot in common between these two. So some of the tools that we see being used globally to address ORSA are probably things that we should be considering for the ICAAP process as well, because there's a lot of similarities for those two. And I think scenarios, for example, is one of the tools that I think can be very effective to deal with this multi-year time horizon and to really get the board and the company engaged. So thank you very much. I'll pass on to Mike.
Thanks, Michael. I just want to spend a bit of time today talking through a journey that I went on of taking of explaining risks to capital in a practical setting. Back in 2005, I was the marketing actuary for an overseas branch of a UK life company, and I was based in Luxembourg. And a couple of events occurred. One is that we acquired a German life assurance company, and which effectively doubled the size of the business that I was in. And secondly, the UK head office gave us autonomy on pricing and profit reporting, but at the expense that we had to introduce financial risk and impose a UK ICA style approach onto the management of the organisation. And the relevance of that approach is the techniques that we used are very similar to the APRA capital techniques that have just been published for Australia. So I was in a fortunate position to be on a Friday a marketing actuary and on the following Monday to be head of actuarial, a massive change in my job. And I'd just like to take you through three points on how I try to embed the risk in the business. The first step was to set up a suitable governance. The second was to bring across financial risk policies. And the third was embed that risk thinking into day-to-day management actions. Starting with the governance, that was quite simple because the UK head office had a set of governance policies. All I had to do was get out that, get the Tipex out, change some names, and I now I automatically tick, I've done step one. Well, I hadn't really. All I had was a set of a charter of how we would operate, but in fact we had no information to give to those committees. For an asset liability committee, we didn't understand how the German company would work. We didn't understand how the UK branch business based in Luxembourg would operate under an ICA approach. So I set up and hired some people to bring across the UK policies and to localise them. And that was a very non-trivial task. Whilst, say, 80-odd percent of the information was sort of standard actuarial stroke financial risk information, the last 20% was quite difficult. You had to overcome the cultural differences between Germans and people in the UK, people in Luxembourg. We had Italian office, Austrian office, etc. So I brought in an actuary to do that, but an actuary who'd spent 20 years as a general manager of a business. So he had focused his career around people management rather than the techniques. I needed some people to do the complicated stuff that we saw earlier on. So one of my managers was given a budget to hire a couple of contractors to set up the profit models in the German life company that could replicate and produce the ICA numbers. His responsibility was to write the reports, sort of the typical board-level reports you'd write for ICA, and also to ensure that the systems that were being developed were easy to use, and once the contractors left the firm after a 12-month, the day-to-day staff, the actuarial staff, could run the models when we wanted to do so the year later. And thirdly, we sort of done some very back-of-the-envelope rough calculations for the overseas branch business on an ICA basis. There was no point reinventing the wheel for that. We just done some simple approximation techniques. So with that base of information, it was, how did I go about embedding that risk thinking into the business? I took a two-stage approach. The first stage was to get buy-in from people interested in risk-based and the new sort of financial risk and financial mathematics. And this, once we were comfortable with that, then we could walk that approach through the general managers in the business. So there's a natural group in a life company who's interested in financial risk, and that's the actuarial community. So I invited all the qualified actuaries to come to a monthly financial risk working group. And the title there, the working group, was important. It didn't report into any of the senior management. We wanted some time and space separate from them to develop what worked and what didn't work, and to bring in ideas and for people to contribute freely to those ideas. It was quite wide ranging, but we did spend a lot of time on the numbers from the ICA. What were the univariate stresses? What does 99.5% probability mean? And we discussed them at length. We produced the documentation. We produced the enabled the system to be replicated each and every year. We changed things like the pricing reports to introduce a lot of qualitative and quantitative information on financial risk whenever a new product was launched. And an output of all that took about 18 months, but a big output was we created a monthly dashboard, which gave an early warning system of things that were happening in the business. We would work through what risks were in the ICAs and how would we measure them on a monthly basis. We could measure some of the risks monthly, but some others we'd have to use some sort of proxy rating factors and produce a very simple, effectively two-page dashboard. One page would be, well, half a page was on profit, half a page was on capital, and one page an explanation. And that information could then go into an asset liability committee, which could go into sort of an executive management report. Independently, I would take that to the parent company's group risk committee and explain what these numbers meant. And then I could get the benefit of the advice of very senior people gained their comfort, we knew what we were doing, but B, got their advice and guidance on other ways to progress these ideas. I did also was quite pleased and had evidence that the management actually read this information. The chief executive phoned me up one day and he'd noticed that swaption prices had fallen significantly. Should we go and buy some? Because he thinks they'd go up next month. It wasn't really the point of the dashboard, but it was evidence that people were looking at it, and that was important. So that was taking it through a bunch of interested people up to a board level type thing, which is, it's not mechanical, but it's certainly easier than the other thing that we're talking about these days, and that's to take it to the wider general management and embed risk-based thinking to them. So because I'd been in the company for quite a long time and I knew everyone, I went to the sort of the most friendly sort of functional director, and who was the head of administration, and I spent a couple of hours talking to her about these issues and what we'd done and how we were measuring and monitoring everything. And at the end of the meeting, she just said, well, you know, you've confirmed my expectations. You've come along as an actuary. You've told me something that's far too complicated. There's too much jargon. And more importantly, it's absolutely not clear what you want me to do. So I went away from that, a bit of failure. But her advice was, look, just go away, take 6 months a year, really think it through. You have to use layman's terms. There's no point talking the way you did before. And there's two things you have to come back. And you have to tell me, how does it affect her staff? And also, what do you expect them to do as a result of this information? So it was really about another year. We went through the sort of risk, the monthly financial risk working group, taking a few ideas and sort of debating what would work, what wouldn't work. What we didn't want to do was introduce a whole new load of jargon for the staff, because we were pretty constrained by the jargon we were using. We wanted to use a similar jargon that the board would understand, and which was fairly standard. But we did sort of, instead of talking about market risk, liquidity risk to the general managers, we started talking about risks that may occur and sort of avoidable risks. We didn't talk about 99.5% probabilities or 1 in 200. We just used general words like extreme events may occur, and the regulator suggests that we should think about extreme events. We went back and talked through the risks. When we split the risks up that way, we still went through some of the numbers, but it was really a case of, these are things that may occur, these are things you have absolutely no control over, we don't expect you to do anything with this information apart from understand that this may occur. However, there's a whole load of risks that are avoidable, and your input and your staff's input could help us reduce these numbers. Clearly, there's sort of operational risks, but we would talk more widely, for example, say lapse risks. We were sort of talking about your department, for example, to a particular person does all the lapse claims. They get the information in when people are doing lapses. Well, could you tell us earlier when those lapses are occurring? Is there anything you could do to reduce those lapses? Now, that may be more on the profit than the capital side, but it was just an example of trying to get them to think about the risks in the business. And one outcome from meeting a lot of the general people is, whilst they'd had product training on the sort of the functionality of the products, there were a lot of people that were interested in these sort of extreme events and what happened. So we just embarked on a training program. I took this of the UK products because I developed them many years ago, and one of my German colleagues took the German products to his colleagues. And we just sort of done some training programs once a year on these issues. But I felt I wanted to embed it a bit better than doing a training program once a year. And we couldn't give them the dashboard for, one, it was sensitive information in there, two, it was too complicated, there was too much jargon in there. So we tried and failed many times with various information. But one of the last things we tried, which I think was getting closer to explaining risks, was a very simple system, a very simple traffic light system. We'd had the opportunity to go around and talk to people about various products and how we could lump them together and how various risks were associated with each product. And I just wanted to sort of keep the information alive rather than just doing it every 12 months. I just put some simple colours, some simple statements in there that, A, if it fell into our enemy's hands, wouldn't cause us too much damage. I was very aware that this was going to be published on our company intranet and sent around. But I did get people talking about it. I put it into... the chair of the pricing committee reported it into me, so I got him to slip this in every month and types of things like that. Overall, was it working? I was just on a journey, and I think we were... going in a good way of getting people to think about risk at a general level, but the big thing I felt is don't be too quantitative about the numbers. My final slide I'll talk about for a couple of seconds. This is just something very simple and knocked up. As soon as I started trying to put real numbers in anywhere, it really confused everybody. And one of the first times I had a chat like this, somebody came up to me not long after meeting, and they were really worried about their job, because they could see required capital 140. We produced this as about March time. We were 3 months into the financial year, and they could see that we only had 50 capital left. We didn't really mean that, but it's an example of, as soon as you bring in numbers, you need a lot more explanation. So we quickly dropped those ideas and went back to some sort of more of this. But thanks for listening to me, and please, if you've got any questions. Okay.
Is there any more you want to cover? If you need to say there's no question to ask, this question, can you please state your name and then ask?
question?
It's Anthony Bryan. I got a couple of comments and I'd be interested in your responses to them. Early on you talked about sort of economic and regulatory capital. I guess what I've seen is you've got economic capital, potentially regulatory capital under various regimes, depending on what parents and what countries they are in, and then a third capital for those listed companies because they want to have a rating that means they're at least AA or AAA. So there's multiple uses of it, and whether you see that being used in the one model, that sort of thing. One of the things we see also, you talked about stress testing being a form of scenario analysis. One of the other things we see as a good practice is called stressing to failure. It's one thing to say, well, let's have a stress test and that's a 1% or a 5%, which gives some information, but talking about how big a stress do you need before we fail in these areas is something that can produce very useful information for boards and for management to say, well, this scenario is how unreal, but how unreal does it have to be before we fail, or how far is a stress from a failure sort of situation? And I guess the other thing is the use of these sorts of models to help identify triggers for actions, things like if you're writing group business, how many group schemes do we need to write before we, need to go and rethink about our catastrophe cover, or our reinsurance concentration is getting too large for this reinsurer, and that sort of thing. So those sorts of use of models to say how much capacity before we actually need to step in, rather than saying at the end of each year we'll look at what the year's done and see whether we need to rearrange our capital requirements or our reinsurance arrangements.
Maybe I can start going back to the first one about the various types of capital and particularly linking into our credit ratings and things like that. Certainly what we've seen in a number of cases is essentially the level of sufficiency with which ECAP, more commonly, is set is to achieve a AA rating. So I think that's certainly been used, ECAP models, to a level of confidence such that ratings are comfortable with double A rating. So I think that certainly is a comment on the first one. I'll probably be able to answer it.
Just a further comment on the first question as well. I was actually surprised going over to Europe. There was a very strong focus that regulatory and economic capital should be the same. The Swiss regulator viewed, it's embedded in Solvency II as well, in the use test, and it needs to be used throughout the company, the regulatory capital calculation. So kind of twinning those two concepts together was something that regulators in particular were very keen to see happening. And linking back to credit rating as well, through the risk appetite statement, that seemed to happen in a lot of places as well. After a 1 in 200 year event, we want to be at least BBB rated or something along those lines. So I think that they are certainly sort of very closely linked in a lot of circumstances. In Australia, I think it's interesting that for life insurance in particular, that we have the situation where regulatory capital is often larger than economic capital. So it sort of introduces some interesting challenges for us. In terms of the stress to failure comment, I certainly agree that is a very useful tool. I see that as one subset of the whole idea of scenarios, which is you could do a stress to failure at a single point in time, immediately as at the valuation date for that capital, or you could see what happens if you did the same at a later point in time after a certain event. So just opening that up to a longer time frame. I think that I've heard that called also a reverse scenario, so as a subset of that, where you start with a given loss and then you make assumptions and build the scenario such that you will be able to produce that result. And that could be one which is a stress to failure, or it could be one which is almost a failure, or it could be something else, but the idea that you're starting with an outcome and then finding the storyline to fit that outcome. I think that's a subset of what are many other different types of scenarios you can come up with. I mentioned a couple before, looking at historical, making some up, which is synthetic, really looking at global scenarios and sort of marrying that in with economic projections and economic commentary that your company or more broadly might be available. Just a single comment to your last question there, or comment on the use of models for triggers. I certainly see that to be
something which is vital for the AUSA and ICAAP process, this full cascading down, starting at the real bedrock of risk appetite, moving that on to saying what your tolerances are, your limits, and setting those limits with respect to individual risk types. And then having those concrete with quantifiable metrics, such as capital or such as earnings changes, is, I think, essential to get any real flow through for implementing it within your business. And breaking it down with real numbers is really where it starts to get tricky. In terms of turning that into actions, I don't think that that is perhaps as great a challenge as incorporating and really working out what those limits are. I think when things go bad, people can come up with a list of ideas of things they can do to make it better, or what kind of reactions we should have. But it is very interesting to see that education process evolve through the course of a scenario. If you start putting scenarios in place and the board starts making decisions, there comes a point in time with some of the kind of scenarios that creep upon the board where they suddenly say, oh, right, actually what we've done so far in this workshop or this scenario that we're entertaining isn't really what we should have done today, so now we've got to flip over and start acting in a different way. And how the board or how a group of people reacts to that decision point when that realisation comes, I think is a crucial point. And if you don't get that flipping over, right, we've made mistakes and now we're going to do something different, then it sort of all goes pear-shaped from there. So I think that's the kind of key comments I'd make with regards to triggers.
Just add one more to the, I suppose the use of economic capital is, and reinsurance, you mentioned the word reinsurance there, reinsurance optimisation is a classic use of ECAP, for the given levels of threshold you'll take on, you're going to reinsure, what's going to give you the greatest return on your ECAP or whatever other sort of measure you want to use. So certainly, that you can take that a step further to the point where you've got you're able to crunch that more frequently than just when your business changes or if there's an acquisition or a change in product mix or something like that, which people would probably typically only look at that every couple of years. You can get to the point where you're able to look at that on a more continuous basis here, that once the models are set up in theory, that shouldn't actually be that hard to do.
Martin Mulk here. A question for Mike Callan. I was really interested in the advice you were given about your presentation. If I heard you correctly, you were told to go away and come back and tell us how it's going to affect my team and what you want me to do as a result. This seems like pretty good advice for any presentation or report. How did you check that you were successful in meeting those requirements?
She did say go away, quite clearly, and I did choose it because she'd been very frank and good advice. It's like I said, quite often you get lost in the detail of things and not realise you're pontificating rather than asking something to do something. I went back, and I think it was probably about, I can't remember exactly, between 6 weeks and a year before we had the next meeting, and I did have quite a few attempts within our monthly working group for explaining things. The downside there is there's a positional power thing, I'm sharing it, and they're all reporting to me, so they can say yes, yes, yes. And B, they were all actuaries and said yes, 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 because it was all obvious to them. So I did take it to a couple of other friendly people. In fact, the worker was the, at the time, he was the chief exec of the German business, and I've known him a long time. And so stage two was really with him. He didn't quite say go away, but he was still not really getting there, I think, but it was hard way. And I went to see him about two or three times before, and then the final time, it was much clearer what he's saying, it was much clearer, I can understand, because you've personalised the information. You haven't come up to me and talked about the balance sheet and risks, it's very much all sciences, these are the types of things that go on in your area. These could lead to losses, if X, Y, Z happened.
we have the cost settlement effect there to cover those risks. So we'd like your staff to understand them better to reduce the costs of it. But also, we don't want to come to you and tell you all the risks are. We'd like your staff to be involved in the process and tell us what they see is the risk. Mm-hmm. So when I went back to the acting director, I had a much better idea of the outputs I wanted from it, but also making it a more inclusive conversation and personalising it better. I took a couple of colleagues from the team. I knew what roles they took, and I wanted to the discussion was about them, not about what the funding source of financial is.
Okay, thank you. So personalising, and the other point was? And inclusive, yeah. Okay, well done. Very clever.
Another question? Yes. Jenny, someone's been through
the line. Hi, Suzanne Soldra. I just wanted to ask about the CRTI, Capital and Risk Transfer Instrument approach. If a regulator is allowing someone to use an internal model, and that particular institution has both a CRTI and a consolidated approach, does it require them to use the CRTI capital? Has that situation arisen?
First of all, I mean, I think that depends on the particular regulator. I mean, Europe is, a conglomeration of a lot of different states, and they've got this idea of a college of regulators. But realistically speaking, it's the individual countries' regulators that are regulating for the companies which have specified their head office in that area, or they're the key regulator for that group. So I think that's one part of the question. Well, it depends on the regulator. The second part of the answer to that question is that I think this CRTI stuff is reasonably new. So I don't think that there are many companies out there at the moment that have actually started and completed successful implementations of this to date. There might be, I'm not aware, but I am aware that it is quite new and the companies are only just starting to kind of look at some of these issues. So I think they're two of the key points. The second is, I think, marrying this view with the internal view of the company. There are different companies that I talk to more generally in Solvency II, because actually, Solvency II doesn't apply to groups, it applies to legal entities. So the ORSIP, for example, actually has to be done for each legal entity within the group, which throws up a lot of kind of challenges for groups, which can have hundreds or sometimes even thousands of legal entities within the broader group. Do all of these have boards that sit there and have to run their own ORSIP process? Do all of them need to have their own models? All these kinds of questions. So. And generally speaking, the internal view that the company takes to be able to handle these complications on a day-to-day basis can often be one that says, we are a group and there are free capital flows. We ignore these different entities. So whether or not a regulator has come knocking on their door and said, hey guys, we've heard this great new idea about modelling CRTIs as capital and risk transfer instruments, if the internal view of the company doesn't marry with that, there's probably going to be some challenges. Culturally and from an implementation point of view.
Jenny Lyon, I think you might have answered my question to some extent, but I was interested in those capital flows and who you were doing this work for, is in terms of whether you're talking to the board at group level so it can understand what might happen in an ongoing basis and then in a crisis situation, and does that information flow through to the other entities that report into it, and so are those boards of directors aware, and are they sufficiently aware, I guess, of the implications of, in a crisis situation, those flows that they expected to happen on an ongoing basis are no longer going to be there. So I was interested really in where your relationship is in doing that kind of work. Does it flow right through the organisation?
I've only seen this implemented from the top down at a group level, like the regulator talking to the group and saying, we're interested to know how things would work in a stress scenario with your different legal entities. I've also seen it appreciated at a group level, but not through the regulator, but through companies' own Solvency II programs, where they've started to try and
come to grips with these ideas, not so much from a modelling perspective, because the models for this other client were already on a consolidated basis, and they hadn't thought to go down that path, and they had no appetite to go down that path. But in terms of the extra layer of the models, so the awesome models, I guess, the risk and capital management, what really happens to decision-making contingency processes for sub-entities when they've got to make decisions about capital and in these stress scenarios. And it's almost by the very nature of the requirements being 1 in 200-year requirements that you almost have to consider these things, because it's hard to conceive of how you could have one of those kinds of events or series of events to cause that kind of capital strain where you didn't also have the strain on those relationships as well, if they were able to be restrained in the first place and the setup of the group was such that these kind of problems systemically existed.
Hi there, Bridget Brown. Maybe I didn't quite understand what you were getting at with the CRTIs, but I would have thought that was a basic finance, treasury, liquidity management issue when you set up organisations thinking about structures, and I think accountants probably have long thought about that, or maybe actuaries haven't thought about it enough. And I think that's partially Solvency II doesn't really address that well, in my understanding, because it's focused on an economic balance sheet which doesn't take into account liquidity per se. I mean, it takes into account liquidity risk, of course, but it doesn't actually look at physically, can you access the value in the different portfolios? Can you access the capital beyond the tiering classifications? And the finality of all of that is that in any case you should be able to sell off the different pieces if you need to access the value in them. So I was a bit I was thinking maybe I've missed this new thing, but it seemed quite a fundamental basic of managing a financial organisation.
Yeah, I mean, I 100% agree with you, especially the comments you're making at the end, that in terms of how they appreciate capital. I think in terms of the structures, the comment at the beginning, saying, well, lawyers and the legal teams have looked at these structures and set them up in a way such that it appreciates these things. I think, yes, that's true, but I also think that companies grow organically, and the reasons why things were done at the beginning change in 10 years, mm-hmm. and sometimes in 20, 30, 40, 50 years, you get a history, a legacy of different corporate structures that are sitting there. And there are capital and risk transfer instruments aligning with many of these that people don't really know, don't understand, and if the legal entities themselves aren't used for their original purposes anymore because there's been a new reason that's come along or whatnot, then it can be convoluted and complicated.
Definitely. I mean, I guess the insolvency accountants are the ones who are the most expert in this, and I guess Lehman Brothers was an excellent example of what can happen when everybody shuts down and looks after only their own exact interests.
Exactly, and I think that was the kind of impetus that got people starting to think about this kind of stuff.
Okay. Thanks.
Oh, and that's it. Can you all say your thanks to Peter, Michael, and Mark?